Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Monday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, SportsZone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online. And at our website, stevebick.com. And what a particularly fabulous Saturday. It was a marathon, not a sprint, and the whole weekend, really. After we left you at noon and the focus on Belmont Day, plenty of other interest and result to consider around the country. Santa Anita wrapping up the winter, spring. Focus will turn to Los Al for a couple of weeks before Del Mar steps forward. Still a few more weekends yet here in New York before Saratoga and Churchill, Foster card on Saturday, already drawn. It's the summer, July 4th weekend, not far off. Hope everybody had a fabulous Father's Day. Certainly the kind of Sunday, at least I think on the Eastern Seaboard, can't speak for everywhere in the country, but it was certainly a beautiful day here. Really a Saturday in particular, just from start to finish with Royal Ascot, the last day, and so many interesting results to discuss. Nick Luck will be here to start hour two. We'll talk to Graham Motion, too, because sharing with a noble effort, settled for a second. That was in the coronation, that was as honest a try as you could want. And Graham with a couple of stake wins in New York, too, to fold in. So I wanted to get Graham Motion's reaction. But there's so much of, I've got a list here of things that I want to get to, and we should probably pace it for a couple of days because some of the connections we won't reach until tomorrow, like Neil Drysdale. How about Drysdale's dual success on Saturday? The filly and the mare. Toinette, as Jay Privman lauded, and Alexandra in the Jiper. Pretty cool. Neil will join us tomorrow to talk about his day. He's waiting for his assistant to come back from New York. And so today he couldn't, he said, I can't come on till 10. We're done by 10, but that's all right. We'll get Neil Drysdale tomorrow. There is so much to get to, and I'm obviously reserving the Tis the Law Belmont performance, and reviewed the day yesterday on Capital OTV with Seth Merrow, and it is just, yeah, there's no superlative about where this story is going that you can't include. It just has everything that makes the game so engaging and fun to follow, fun to bet on, fun to be a fan of. Barkley Tag and Robin Smulin and Robin, you know, really, they're an entry and are just so, you know, so much entwined and this portion, these last couple of decades, particularly of Barkley Tag's outstanding career. At one point, I wanted to drive home Saturday night. It occurred that with him winning a Belmont, and of course with Funnyside's dual classic success 17 years ago, Barkley Tag joins Wayne Lucas, Nick Zito, and Bob Baffert among contemporary horsemen that have won all three races. And I don't, frankly, I don't want to hear about the mile in the eighth, because this race could have been, I said to Seth yesterday, I said that they could have been running this at Sheepshead Bay. They could have run this race at Morris Park at 2.5 miles, and Tis the Law was going to win by open lengths. And, his qualities, it's funny, the tendency and the, one of the storylines when it comes to Funnyside and Sacatoga, Jack Knowlton and his team and all the partners, it's irresistible to bring up Funnyside on the Tis the Law and make those parallels. But one thing is very much a parallel, and that is, this is a horse that can put himself in a race and be in a position to succeed, like Funnyside was. People said, oh, Funnyside gets these great trips. Yeah, that's right, because he has a gear that can set him up, to stalk speed and to, to sit comfortably. This horse is the same way. He's tractable and responsive, and with each passing start, it is becoming more formidable. And the plan from here is obvious. Travers, and as we talked with Dave Grenig on Friday, the release of the Saratoga Stakes schedule by Naira, and the timing and the distance element, the mile and a quarter, and then the Derby goal and the Preakness and the Breeders' Cup. It's laid right out there. And I understand, people are saying, well, the Nadal wasn't there, and Maxfield wasn't there. And you can only go to your goals and arrive at your destination and run against, what's available. But right now, it seems that this is, the best horse among the sophomores. He put an exclamation on the expectations. A huge win, obviously, for Manny Franco. I don't know if you follow Sid Fernando on Twitter, and of course Sid, very close to the barn, in part because of Mr. Fipke and Barkley long association with Chuck Fipke's horses. And Sid went and visited yesterday at Belmont and put up some wonderful video interview clips with Robin and Barkley. And Robin Smulin had some really interesting sidebars. And it will, some of these things we've discussed already with Barkley Tag. But Robin brought up a great anecdote about the post Kentucky Jockey Club third place finish, which is the only blemish on the record. And she called Ramon Dominguez. She wanted a neutral observer, and Ramon hadn't seen the race live, but he watched it for Robin and came back and had very interesting things to say, none of which included a criticism of Manny Franco's ride. And so you know, the teeth gnashing and hand wringing that went on over that, you know, was frankly, you know, silly at the time, and is now, you know, far back in the rearview mirror at this point. So the Tis the Law performance was, you know, part of what was a day that had any number of dominant efforts. And on the sprint side, we'll shift gears for a second. I mean, to some degree, Tis the Law's win, I think, you know, we all anticipated, and it did make the multi-race wager attempts, made it, you know, a little bit easier. And in fact, I don't, maybe tomorrow with Andy, the 2-day pick five ended up being a tremendous play. It paid over $700. And by all rights, there was really only fetching in that first race on Friday. That was the toughest horse to come up with, and if you got to fetching, you were on your way to, you know, the $1 increment made it a little tricky, and it got a lot of play, over 300,000 with very little notice, but that was some value. I think the parlay was like 220, and it paid 700. With Jack and Noah, and congratulations to Gary Barber. Those are his grandchildren. Those are his grandsons. They're twins. Very cool. When it came to the dominant performances, there was just any number to discuss here, including the 2 3-year-old turf races. I mean, Decorated Invader, and you heard, I think it was Dave Grenick, right? That Dave lauding, you know, how special Decorated Invader likely was, and boy, he's exciting. And Sweet Melania was terrific, even better than anticipated. Even though you kind of knew she was going to have a little bit of an edge on a pace front, you know, she was going to get the lead, but still, she powered away. And then there were the 2 sprint races, and No Parole, that race, we're going to talk to Tom Amos after we talk to Andy Beyer. Andy's going to join us here in the next few minutes, and then Tom Amos. But No Parole, that race, when he took control as quickly and with as much authority as he did, and when nobody really was able to engage him, that race was over. I'm watching, I'm saying to myself, well, forget it, this is over. Going into the turn, you could see that, you know, No Parole, Saez was, you know, sitting motionless, and everybody else was working to keep up. And then came Gamine's effort, which was so stunning and so phenomenal, and all the superlatives that came pouring out, and I mean, just an eye popping, you know, one of those efforts where you see a horse gaining momentum, you know, as they roll, and just a wow effort. I saw the time go up, and I, you know, you think to yourself, well, is that right? And 18 3/4 lengths for Michael Lund Peterson and the Into Mischief filly was just amazing. Amazing. They're thinking about maybe shortening up a little bit in the test before stretching back out for the Oaks. Gamine, unbelievable. And you know, Baffert has talked about her talent and, you know, what the expectations have been really from early on. You know, but being down inside, you wondered, and, you know, the interesting thing is that you do have to still... The mile in the eighth around 2 turns, that might be that this configuration really is in her wheelhouse as well. You know, I mean, this is a slight cutback from the mile in the 16th. at Oaklawn, but it's still the one turn, and I'm sure it's seven eighths. I mean, as well. So that'll be in the back. Probably should be in the back of your mind. But this was outstanding, and a 110 buyer. We're going to talk to Andy because a case could be made that that Andy was being conservative, and you know there was also parts of the day that were intriguing. And, you know, and Andy always visits after Triple Crown races, and so we got plenty to talk about with him. And one of the things that was, you know, tricky, it seemed on the day, it felt like the racetrack got faster as the day went on, because and we're particularly going to talk to Andy about No Parole versus Happy Saver, that first time starter for Wertheimer and Todd Pletcher, because the times were very close. The internals were different. The races structurally were a little different, but there's a considerable spread between the two horses. But Andy's going to answer everything because he's with us right now. Andy Beyer, good morning.
Thanks.
There we go. Andy, good morning.
Morning. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Andy, I assume you heard me, you know, kind of riffing there, and you know, I don't want to necessarily start with the 3-year-old sprints, because just on the whole, the day was really interesting, and we had a lot of dominant performances. I suppose Gamine and Tis the Law are the focal points to get this going.
Should we start with Tis the Law? He has a lot of virtues. He's done everything right. Run a good race every time. He's got a trainer I respect immensely. But in his career to date, he still has not run a notable figure or really beaten a field that I say, gee, this stamps him as a terrific horse. I mean, I thought that the Belmont was going to be the race where he really stepped out and showed what he could do. I mean, that here he are, you know, mid-June for a 3-year-old, they're starting to get, it's not like a normal Kentucky Derby where horses are really kind of being forced to, get a mile and a quarter before they want to. This was a perfect spot for him to do something spectacular, and I thought he was just workmanlike. The speed figure of 100 is unexceptional. You look at the horses who were behind him. I mean, Dr. Post and Max Player and Pneumatic, none of whom were serious stakes horses. I just didn't, I salute him, but I don't think this is a special horse.
Well, that's interesting, at least yet. It seemed like he did it at will. I mean, from that standpoint, yeah. And basically dispatching, I mean, even if it is an average or a mundane group, he was pretty dismissive of this field.
Well, he's supposed to be dismissive of Dr. Pope.
There you go.
But let's face it, he's now run six times, and they're really good horses. I mean, great horses run fast. They don't run races in the 90s or 100, and then when they're finally tested, they run a 110 and show their greatness. They somewhere along the line, they run a fast race, and as a believer in speed figures, I can say that over the last half century, because that is. That is usually true. I mean, great horses will, they don't have to do it every time they run, but they'll give you that fast race, that big number, and still waiting for Tis the Law to do it.
Well, and it will be interesting because to get the first classic distance trials, the Travers is going to be the first opportunity for these sophomores to run 10 furlongs. That'll be August 8th. And then in quick succession, you know, we're going to have the Derby and the Preakness and Breeders' Cup. So the tests are going to come at the classic trip. So from that standpoint, we'll look forward. Let's jump a couple of about an hour earlier, and you said 110. That might be the magic number for discussion purposes. Gamine's effort, Andy, was just eye popping.
Yes, this was a jaw dropping performance, and the time was so fast, even in the in the context of a very souped up racetrack, I hesitate to use the adjective great for this race. I do not lightly compare any filly to Rachel Alexandra, who to me is my favorite horse of the millennium, but this was a Rachel Alexandra type performance. I mean, we remember when Rachel won the Kentucky Oaks by a million lengths. She got a figure of 108, and that really stamped her as a superstar, and she went on to prove it, beating males three times. So Gamine with 110, there was nothing phony about that race. I mean, she's the best 3-year-old around, and I just I hope that she gets the kind of some opportunities the way Rachel did to do things that are exceptional, not just beat a bunch of ordinary fillies in the Kentucky Oaks or something like that.
Well, and this was this was what you mentioned, Rachel. This was one of those performances where you could see. You could see the horse gaining momentum. I mean, it was like a snowball. It was like that avalanche style where the motion that the horse is putting out is like gaining energy as they go, and never really was asked to run by Johnny.
Right. Well, I don't think when they run 132 and change, I can't imagine in a last quarter and 23.2, I can't imagine there's a huge amount.
How much
left
more in the tank?
This was a performance that really if you're a racing fan, you gotta love, and it just brings you out of your chair.
Now, Andy, here's a perfect opportunity to delve into what was going on the racetrack as the day progressed. And there was 2 hours between dirt races. This is something we usually talk about on Derby Day, when there's that mammoth spread leading up to the Derby, because of the whatever bourbon named Turf Classic. And there was Happy Saver, the first-time starter, the Wertheimer Pletcher, at about 2:20, and then 2 hours later came the Acorn. But even 2 hours earlier, there was No Parole, and I'm curious, what your thought was immediately after No Parole's effort, and then how you think things were changing, because the spread right between the 2 7 furlong races says that you thought the track was speeding up.
Right. There's no doubt that the track speeded up, and I don't understand why. Other than their staff, I mean, they're very hip. They're attuned to what's going on the track, and they'll manicure it to get it the way they want it. But when you've got horses versus, you know, going 7 furlongs at 121 early in the card, and so got, and then you got to, you make it faster. I don't see the need for that, but it was, you know, it was fine. I'm pretty confident. You know, we did the right thing with our figures. We made a variant for races 2 and 3, and then the track was 10 points faster. Now, you know, Happy Saver, you know, could have been in the middle between, you know, the changes, but I mean an 89 for him was pretty good. I mean the horse he beat, the Angry Man, had run a 64 in his debut, you know, and now we give a 79 to. I mean I think that's the right, that was the right decision, but we'll certainly monitor it. The 89 made sense for those horses, but then the remaining races, there was kind of no doubt. It was it was obviously very, you know, very fast, and I thought that the figures for Gamine and Tis the Law, you know, really, really fit what, you know, what happened in those races. So that's our view. I mean, the Happy Savior race could be ambiguous, but you know, that if they were working on the track, the time that they would kind of have the most opportunity to do it was with an intervening turf race, and so the fact that there was you had the races 2 and 3 and then a turf race and then Happy Saver in the fifth, I mean, that just seemed the logical place to split the variant.
Well, and you bring up, you know, the germane point, because when you look at the Angry Man and Oh Trouble that were five, almost six lengths behind Happy Saver versus Echo Town in particular, 3 3/4 back of No Parole. I mean, Echo Town has got a very established standard where he is in the 90s, and so, you know, that
right, that
when
was,
I saw the
that
when
was,
I saw the number
solid. You know, I mean, the second and third races, they weren't going to be any lower than that.
Because that's right, and well, Indian Pride was the 6.5, that was the 6.5 for a long,
correct.
And she ended up with a I think I wrote it down somewhere. There it is. 87 for her.
Yeah. While we're talking speed figure subtleties, you know, we spoke earlier, I believe, about the performance, or emailed back and forth about the performance of Tappet to Win in early June, mm-hmm. at Belmont. And it was a really, really fast race. And if we'd taken it, if you're a speed handicapper and you took it at face value, this would have been a big, big number, and he would have had the standout speed figure in going into the Belmont. And we looked hard at that race, and you know, you don't want to make a mistake, you know, in a high profile setting like this, but we couldn't, and I just could not accept that field running a monster figure and lowered the number to a 97. People often criticize it for, oh, you're being subjective, you're overriding the data. Well, sometimes you look at the information and you say, this can't make sense, we've got to override it. And I think the performance of Tap to Win on Saturday certainly indicated that we made the right decision in that case. We were maybe too generous to him with the 97.
Well, and you know, he set an honest pace, making the three quarter in 109 and 4, and the mile went in 134 and 2. I mean, it 146 and 2 for Tis the Law. Even if the track, you know, was quick, the mile and an eighth, that's, as they say, that's racehorse time. Andy, I thought stayed on well enough. I mean, for him to hold fifth and get the last decent check, and you know, the closers couldn't get to him. They had every chance, but I guess Max Player, you know, ran okay to be third in here, and Dr. Post ran okay. I mean, they had their opportunities.
Yeah. No, I wasn't thrilled with anybody behind Tis the Law. I mean, I thought that maybe Pneumatic would be a surprise horse in here. I mean, I like the way Steve Asmussen brings his horses along, and they never peak too early. And I thought that he was the horse in that field who might surprise everybody by stepping up, but I guess he's got a little time to do that.
Well, and he was hard pressed. He was going to almost have to be wide every step, it seemed. Because Santana, unless Santana was going to use him hard early to gain position with four left and tap it to win, and instead he sort of found himself, in no man's land in mid pack. So,
wasn't that bad? You got a long way in a mile and an eighth at Belmont to get over to the three path, So. I can't make much of an excuse for him.
Andy, one thing that you should address for people that were, kind of kicking this around yesterday and even Saturday night, because you had the figures done very quickly after the race.
Right.
And explain how you treat those internal fractions between the no parole race and the Happy Saver race. We're going to have Tom Amos next. And, obviously almost a full second faster to the three-quarter mark, 108 and 3 to the 109 and 2 for Happy Saver. How does that, how does that affect your thinking when you're putting, those two kinds of 7-furlong races together?
Well, we weren't putting them together because, our judgment was that the track changed. I mean,
period.
When we look at fractions, we're mostly looking for slow pace situations that might be extreme enough to prevent a horse from running the final time of which he is capable. If they run fast, if they run fast early, we salute them. but we don't, we don't give extra credit for setting a fast pace or having a fast internal split. I mean, this is, that's just trying to cut it a little too fine. We're looking at the final time. Unless there is an extenuating slow pace situation.
I wanted you to flesh that out because it is something that people wonder about, and to interpret or put a spin on Andy's response, I would say that's what pace figures are for when it comes to these are not pace figures.
I've always thought of trying to from my early days as a figure maker, I wondered if I'd experimented with, trying to build a pace component into a final figure, and I decided I couldn't. There are just too many variables. I mean, yes, you can do, what's a Timeform US does is give speed horses extra credit for running fast early, but then what do you do? I mean, what do you do with with close. I mean, it's, you're always penalizing closers. How do, I mean, they should probably get extra credit if they're rallying into a slow pace. But how do you mm-hmm. quantify that? I just never was confident in the logic or mathematics of trying to build that in all that into the figure.
Understood, and we've talked about it over the years many times, and that's why it's just a speed figure, and then everybody can utilize their own interpretation of track bias and trip, and that's what makes the buyer figures so pure. Andy, I appreciate it. A good start to this odd Triple Crown season, and there's a Travers to look forward to in a little bit, and it feels like the racing season has really kind of started now in earnest. So we'll look forward to, you know, to the summer.
Yeah,
I hope we see
Gamine going against the boys somewhere along here. I mean, if it seemed like it might be logical for them to go Kentucky Oaks and then to the Preakness, but we'll see. I want Baffert to give her a chance to really show how great she may be.
Well, this is Andy's point, and then tomorrow Andy Serling will provide the counterpoint to staying against the Phillies. I love it. Andy, thanks so much.
Great talking to you, Steve.
Always great. Andy Beyer, everybody, and Tom Amos listening in. And Tom joins us after the Louisiana Bred by Violence. Violence's first Grade 1 winner and a tremendous accomplishment. Maggie Moss and Tom Amos, no paroles. Woody Stevens, Tom, congratulations.
Thank you so much. That was so much fun. Really, really enjoyed that, and for owners Maggie Moss and Greg Tramontin, it was a big thrill for all of us.
Tom, there's a lot to talk about with this horse and winning a Grade One, and I tried to lay out in a little, you know, just in a Twitter congratulations, what an accomplishment this was, because it's really textbook handling what you did with this horse. A Louisiana bred, faces the owned kind, tests the waters toward, you know, the classic season, cuts back to what looks like the appropriate one turn distance, and then executes a Grade One. I mean, this was drawn up like a handbook.
Well, I appreciate those comments. Thank you. So, you know, to go back and kind of review those races, No Parole being a Louisiana bred, I very well recall the day that I worked him before his first start and called Maggie Moss, and I said, hey, this is not just a good Louisiana bred. This is a really nice horse. So having said that, we did go against the Louisiana breds in a maiden race at the fairgrounds. He ran a very fast time, and he ran them off their feet and won by open lengths. We came back again against Louisiana breds in a numbers of two allowance race. He did the same thing against a higher caliber horse, albeit, as I said, Louisiana breds. So he two for two, and we wanted to see if he could stretch out. We got the opportunity to do that against Louisiana breds at Delta Downs, going a mile. He again won very, very easily. And so, you know, you're at a point right there. Here it is. This is long before pandemic, and we're still thinking the Derby's going to be in May, and, you know, hey, it's time to see what we can do going two turns. We had won going two turns at Delta against Open Company, so off to the level we went. The timing was right for it, you know, No Parole, that's just not going to be what he does. I mean, he's not a two-turn horse. We learned it that day after Nadal, you know, not only hailed us, but hailed the field quite well, and at that point, you've got to decide what you're going to do. I mean, on a little side note, that was right there is where Greg Tramontin became partners with Maggie Moss and the horse. And, you know, his hope, of course, was that the horse would get two turns successfully in the Rebel. He didn't. We had a backup plan. We knew he was a very, very good sprinter. We came back to Oak Lawn after he had time to kind of recover both physically and mentally, ran in a tough allowance race, won that, and then from there we came to New York, and that was just the gray ones don't grow on trees for any of us, particularly in my stable, but that was a heck of a lot of fun.
You drew the rail, and Luis Saez aboard. Talk a little bit about, you know, the expectation and, you know, how you thought things were going to unfold, because it seems like the lead came readily. And talk about the strategy going in and you know, what you saw as the gates opened and proceeded.
Sure. So the strategy was to try to play into what No Parole does best, and that's use his very, you know, he's so athletic out of the gate that he has a chance to really put the rest of the field at a disadvantage in the first 40 yards. Break fast, you know, either, you know, chase him at your peril or allow him to make the lead out of the gate. And so when the decision was made for No Parole to go to New York for this race, which is about 3 weeks ago, I had a rider in mind. And that rider was Luis Saez. I think he's, first of all, he's a great rider. And he's a great rider amongst many greats up there. New York's racing colony, that jocks route is the best in the nation as far as I'm concerned. I said it all Saratoga last year when I was doing the Fox shows, just watching what those guys do day in and day out. And I'm talking about, you know, leading rider down to the one that's 10th in the standings. That's the best riding colony in the nation. So I'd watched Lou ride all last year at Saratoga. I thought he fit my horse really, really well. He was my first call. Kieran was my first call that I made. That's what I wanted. That's who the ownership wanted as well. And he accepted the mount. And so I knew we had our rider and we had our horse. But, you know, if you're a speed horse, you draw the rail, the die is cast. You got to go. But we were going to go no matter what out of the gate. You said that very well, Steve. You know, out of the gate, when he broke laser sharp. And, you know, really in the blink of an eye, it was our race to control. We were in front. We were clear. And, you know, I was watching the race thinking to myself, well, this couldn't have gone any better to this stage. So that was a good feeling.
Well, you could just see going into the turn, everybody else is pedaling, and Saez, you know, hasn't really even asked. And you're sure right about Louis, and it's not restricted to, you know, to dirt or to turf. He has a way of relaxing a horse up front. I'm looking up here at wind pictures for our horses, and here's Pretension and Williams Lucky Gray, and exactly, you know, that same lulling everybody on the front end, and then he picks a perfect time always, it seems, Tom, to quicken away and makes everybody panic, and everybody starts to like beg their horse to go, and he's getting easy acceleration, and if the horse can respond, forget it. He's really good, and I've told this story 100 times. Going back to a Wood Memorial Day when he came up from Florida, David Fox brought him with Hot Summer, and I had not seen him ride in person, and I turned to Fox. I said, "Wow, so this kid can really ride." And David Fox said, "This kid's going to be a star." He said he's got all the tools.
Yeah, and I think what you just described as his characteristics, that's exactly how the Woody Stevens played out. So he makes the lead, you know, now we're into the turn, Belmont's got those big, wide, sweeping turns, and everybody behind us realizes, hey, it's time to get going, or No Parole is long gone. And, you know, they came to us in the turn, and you know, Louis hadn't asked our horse at all. When they turned for home, he did. He quickly cleared the group again. You know, look, and Bill Parole is as smart a racehorse as you'll find. He's got a great temperament. Everything about him, it makes him easy to train. But Train for Home, he's on his left lead. He's well clear of the field. And, you know, he's not switching over his right lead, which something he typically does. So I'm like, that's weird. I don't know why he never went to his right lead in the race. But as Louis said afterwards, this is the sign of a good rider. He goes, I could have easily, you know, moved my hands a little bit and gotten him to switch over to his right lead. But what's the point? I mean, he is doing it easy. He's clearing this field. I'm not going to make him do anything to rattle him mentally that I don't have to do. So, you know, I think day in and day out, particularly people that learn how to watch a horse and what lead they're on in a race, think a lot of a horse finishing on his proper leads. I think that's, I can tell you from 30 years of experience, I think that's totally silly. Okay, you know, now, a horse should definitely be on his inside lead when they're making the turns because, you know, that's the leg they're using the most. They need to angle on the turns, and so that's important. But on the straightaways, you know, if a horse is doing their job, you know, if you're going to sit there and criticize what lead they're on, you're not paying close enough attention to what's going on in a race. So I didn't mean anything about that afterwards. I'm just bringing that up because I happen to notice it. But again, sign of a good rider. You know, he's not going to do more than he has to do. Look, he's an artist in the saddle, you know, and so he's doing the following things in the case of Woody Stevens. He's broke sharp. He got his position. He's now controlling the pace. He's allowing his horse to get a breather on the turn while everybody comes to him, you know, with plenty in reserve. And so, you know, once a rider has done all those things, there's no need to do the other stuff. So I think that's a sign of a very good rider, and it's a credit to Louis Scheer, for sure. And again, it goes back to an earlier comment about the colony in New York. There's so many good riders up there.
Well, the grade one means a lot to so many different people, and I think Maggie Moss's, probably Big World, the most recent, we'll get to Serengeti in a second, and the Fleur-de-Lis challenge coming up on Saturday, but Tom, you provide Hillendale with Violence's first North American grade one winner, and I'm sure, you know, given your roots, Coteau Grove needs a mention in here as the breeder as well.
Oh yeah, look, I mean, that race happened to be early in the day. Oftentimes these big races, they're coming later in the day and you got all day to be thinking about it. To, you know, to win that race, take a deep breath, enjoy the Belmont day, which was fantastic racing, by the way. That made it really, really, you know, nice. And you've got to mention the Louisiana bred program. I mean, okay, we had a New York bred win the Belmont. We're getting used to seeing how the New York breds can compete in open company. So that's not necessarily a wow moment for the New York breds. They're good. They can run against anybody. But I think the program that is really up and coming, and you mentioned Big World, also a Louisiana bred that won a grade one, and not that long ago, a couple of years ago at that, you're seeing this Louisiana bred program getting really, really competitive nationwide. I'm having a little bit of a brain cramp trying to remember the Evelyn Benoit sprinter that won the greatest stake at Saratoga this summer sprinting. But these Louisiana breds, they can take their LA stamp and take it anywhere in the country and be competitive. So yeah, proud of the program, proud of the fact that, you know, it's a Louisiana bred that did it. And don't forget, I mean, no parole. He's been beaten once in his entire life, and that's going two turns. So he is, you know, that race away from being undefeated and really stamping himself as one of the top three old sprinters in the nation.
Well, and has actually now that you mentioned the one loss, the record that No Parole has amassed is very similar to the record that. That 'tis the law has amassed, you know, the one blemish, and you know, the state bred program and state bred program, you know, the law bred, and that's, I hadn't really thought about the parallel between the two. Well, obviously, Tom, with this win in tow, you look ahead to the summer, and you know, the obvious target of the Allen Jerkins. Some thoughts about the season and the expectations going forward.
Sure. So, you know, it's a season that had some disruption, and I think that when August rolls around at Saratoga, there are going to be some new players that are going to be, you know, certainly rising stars. As we see every year in the three-year-old division, the summer seems to bring around this new wave of really good three-year-olds. So, if you know, going to Saratoga with him, if indeed we do run in that race, which will be a decision made between Maggie Moss, Greg Tramatine, and myself, but assuming we do, and it's a logical assumption that we will, you know, the cast of characters is going to be different, for sure. You know, Milk Bowl, like any really good horse, has to show that, you know, he can take all comers. So we'll cross our bridge when we get to it, but I certainly anticipate, you know, some new players and some new very good players that are going to challenge him when the time comes.
No Parole takes the first grade one opportunity going short for the three-year-old boys. There's not a lot of them. This and the Allen Jerkins, and at the end of the year, the Malibu, important all. And No Parole will look forward to the summer with him. Certainly, Tom, looking forward to Saturday and Stephen Foster Day and more. Talk a little bit about Serengeti and coming back in the Florida Lee. This is going to be as anticipated as the co-feature, the Stephen Foster.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can't mention the Florida Lee without mentioning, you know, who gets the star billing, and that's Midnight Sue, champion, a horse that, you know, is competitive against the boys as well as the girls, and is obviously training well. I almost cringe when I read Steve Asmussen's comments about how she's doing, because it's obvious to me she's doing great. So for Serengeti Empress, who's going to take her on Saturday to have a chance to beat her and to beat this reigning champion in Midnight Bisou, you know, we need to be number one on our A game, which I think we are. And we're coming off a bad race in the Apple Blossom. But there's a lot of factors that went into that. You know, part of it is post position. Part of it is race setup. It just, even going into the race, I was very concerned as to how Serengeti would run. And look, make no mistake about it, Serengeti Empress wants to take it to the field early. And she wants to take it to them on their own terms, on her own terms. So she wants to break. She wants to get out in front. She wants to dictate what happens in the race. The beauty of Serengeti Empress, as she did in the Kentucky Oaks right here on the same track at Churchill Downs, is that she can really get up there in a high cruising speed and set some, you know, pretty amazing fractions and keep going. So that leaves the horses behind her in a bit of a quandary. You know, at what point do you start using your energy to try and chase Serengeti Empress? When you look at this field Saturday, on paper, the setup looks pretty good for us to make the lead against this group. I've watched Mike Smith ride these really, really good horses, like a Midnight Bisou and others, enough to know that he will change some of those horses' tactics to based on how he sees the field setting up. Saw it at Saratoga last year with a Bob Baffert horse. I'm trying to remember who it was. But so I'm curious to see how the riders let this race play out, particularly Mike Smith on Midnight Bisou, and how he's going to, you know, look at a horse like Serengeti Empress coming off, as I said, not a very good race, and say, you know, what do I let her get away with on the front end? Because Midnight Bisou, she's tactically, she has speed. You know, what do I let her get away with on the front end? When do I attack? And, you know, I think in a lot of sense, Steve, the race looks to be on paper, and I'm not saying this is the way it plays out, but it looks to be a two-horse race. Sometimes in two-horse races, riders can get too caught up with one another in the race. That's when the good handicapper that has a good closing long shot can come into play. I hope that doesn't happen, but I'll be very curious to see coming out of the first turn. It's a two-turn race, as you know, where those two horses are placed. Mine, I know where we're going to be. We're going to be in the lead. Where is the big favorite? Where's the champ going to be? The champ going to be close on our tail? She's going to give us a few links down the backside. You know, we'll see how it plays out. And one thing that I believe is in our corner in the race is that, you know, our filly, Sarah Getty Empress, she loves Churchill Downs. This is her surface. So if I've got to take on the champ, and a great champ at that, at least I get to do it on a surface that I know my girl really likes.
Yeah, and I was going to bring it up. You're 2-for-3 over the surface, including the trip in the Kentucky Oaks last year. And Bisou, yeah, has run okay. Two-thirds, including the distaff 2 years ago. Part of a terrific Foster card that also includes the Regret and the first 2-year-old graded stake of the year, the Bashford. And looking forward to that. We'll be talking about that card later in the week. Tom, I've got a couple of quick notes to ask you about before we go. And our friend Dan Hart, who's part of the Churchill Downs Racing Club, give us an update about Distant Shore.
Well, the timing of that question is really good. So yesterday, Distant Shore worked 5/8 from the gate at Keeneland. Ainge Graham was aboard. The work went very, very well. I just sent an email to the managing partner, who is Gary Palmisano of Churchill Downs, who manages the Churchill Downs clubs, and said, you know, we're ready to run off of that work and kind of look for a spot. So look for Distant Shore to be in the entry box in the next couple of weeks.
Tremendous. They'll be excited by that news. And got to ask you, too, the Indiana season moves into the second week, and certainly a good start. Last week, Tom, you got out of the gates very well there, and you got a full set of dance cards, three today and as many as two or three tomorrow, a couple of double entries, three or four on Wednesday, etc. Talk about this Enchanted Empire today in the maiden race.
So that's a maiden race scheduled for the grass over at Indiana Grand. And, you know, we talked about how easy No Parole is to train. Well, Enchanted Empire has been a little bit more difficult. So he's we get these young horses that have never started. And they bring their personality to the track with them, and you have to learn how to work with that personality. You know, that has a big influence in how the horse is going to, you know, develop. So for Enchanted Empire, you know, he was a difficult horse to work with at the gate. He's very, for lack of a better word, claustrophobic, didn't really like being in the gate very much, had some issues, actually battled the gate around once in practice and got down underneath the gate and was fine afterwards. But so those things stay with the horse. And so, you know, you begin to have to teach them the gate's okay. It's not your enemy. And that's not always easy. Anyhow, we ended up gelding Enchanted Empire after his after he'd run. And his first start was a complete disaster. I mean, that's not his physical capabilities that came into play in that first start. That's just mentally. And so he's been a hard horse to teach. Today is his third start, and it's a tough race, no question about it. But if I could talk about a horse that I think is going to show improvement and a horse that's going to come from off the pace, he's the one. I just think he's getting it together. I see it in practice. I see it when I work with him in the mornings. So hopefully that plays out in the afternoon. Eventually it will, but hopefully that afternoon is this afternoon.
Nice. Well, I'm glad I asked, because he's a big price, 20-1 in the morning line, and I should also get a follow-up from opening day last week, and that was the maiden winner, that Vanilla Beanback, who won by widening lengths. This is another Empire Maker, and went the 5.5. You wouldn't necessarily think that Empire Maker would be capable at that short of a distance. 68 Buyer, a nice maiden breaker.
That's another good horse to bring up. So, you bring in all your two-year-olds typically in May or June of the given year. So she was one that we brought in last year in May or June. And truly, if I brought my pet dog out there and worked them against each other, my pet dog would have beat her. I could not get any run from Millavine back at all in the mornings. I tried everything. Show speed in the work, allow her to relax in the work, finish up. I mean, just nothing. And really, really was discouraged about her. So, I mean, when they're like that at a very young age, the answer is stop, regroup, and hope like hell. So we did. We stopped, brought her back this year. Now she's 3. She comes back, and I give her that, get acquainted work, just first time across the tracks. She's been back, and maybe at a half mile or so. She works good, and maybe even a little bit better than she did, too. But when I put her in competition after that work, and I watched her work, I was like, I haven't seen that from this horse before. That's a different horse that's working right now than the two-year-old I had. She's much more into it, much more competitive, and much more wants to get out there and do it. And if you look at her work pattern going into the Indiana races, it was very good. And so the reason she ran Indiana is because the races at Churchill were 7/8 of a mile, and this is her first start. I didn't think she was ready for that. So we go to Indiana. I'm driving over. That was opening day. Driving over, the owner, Chris Ewing, gives me a holler and says, hey, I want to make a bet on this horse today, but I can't make a bet. And I said, hey, look, Indiana, you bet $100 on a horse there. It's going to knock your odds down to 3-5. You're not missing anything. Well, that was pretty naive on my part, because the one thing that's different about Indiana this year than years past is that they're handling a lot of money. I mean, you look at the fields there.
Yes.
They read like the Churchill races. You look at the rider standings in the colony there. They read like the Churchill colony there. And they're big fields, and people are betting these fields. So when they're going to the starting gate, they'll be back. It's 3-1. And I'm like, wow, my owner's going to kill me. I thought she'd be 4-5 in the race, and she breaks sharp. If you're a trip handicapper and you enjoy kind of analyzing trips, watch her trip. She breaks sharp. She's not fast enough to get to the lead, so she comes in. She gets behind horses. Remember, she's never run before, and as soon as she gets behind horses, you can tell she is resenting all the dirt she's taking in her face. And about midway around the turn, James Graham is on her, and he's having to actually reach back and encourage her to try to go forward. Finally, James makes the right move, and that is, I'm not going anywhere on the rail. The start is discouraging her. He moves her free pass off the rail. Now she's going to be wide in the turn. She's giving up ground, of course. Then she's a different horse. She starts running again. And that's just inexperience. Inexperience, learning, do things in a race. You can't practice in the mornings. And she comes, runs, and she wins easily. So she'll improve a lot off that first start. And, you'll probably see her in Kentucky, maybe even the short team meet coming up in July. You might see her in the entry box.
Nice. I'm glad I brought her up, and we're going to be featuring Indiana during the season again this year. And Eric Hallstrom said even well in advance of opening day, the stall he couldn't meet the request for stalls. So far, going into the second week, if you haven't been looking at these fields, and of course you got that 11.99% pick 5 that has been paying great. The races have been fun. It's very obvious that they're trying to break as many maidens as possible early in the meet too. I mean, they're writing 3-4 maiden races a day, and that bodes well for for later in the meet for allowances and both the Indiana bred program and the Open Company. It's going to be a very good going to be a very good meet at Indiana Grand. And finally, Tom, since we talked about Maggie and Greg about the win for No Parole, I do have to ask you about the two-year-old, the Super Saver colt. In the fourth on Saturday, just caught my eye. Windcracker for Greg Tramonton.
Yeah, he's prepped well. He's done the things we wanted to do. That race is a bear of a race, but that's how it goes with these maiden two-year-old races. A couple of intermissions in there that cost quite a bit of money for Steve Asmussen, and a very talented field. The first two-year-old race that's going to be going 6/8 mile, 6 furlongs. The races leading up to this one have all been less in distance. So I think this race coming up is more judgment of what this group is talent-wise as it pertains to the future versus what some of these previous maiden races have been, just in terms of precociousness, because they've been 4.5 furlongs or 5/8 mile, something like that. So a really good race, in my opinion. But it'll be the first two-year-old that start this year. So, look, Windcracker has done everything right, and we're ready to go. He's a horse for two turns, and no doubt about that. But I expect him to put on a good showing Saturday at Churchill Downs.
Excellent. Well, and it's a solid family. Samuel de Champlain, the Henry the Navigator, gelding that won the Charlie Barley up at Woodbine and was second in the summer going back 5-6 years. This is a productive family. And, of course, we saw that Super Saver Firster from Todd on Saturday. Happy Saver. And speaking of which, Tom, your impression... I was going to say, give us some impressions about what else went on Saturday between Gamin and Tis the Law and so forth.
I'll start with Tis the Law. So I watched this Florida Derby. We covered that on Fox Sports. I thought it was visually very impressive. I thought his Belmont was the same. He never looked like anything but the winner to me out of the starting gate. He is, in my opinion, if not the top three-year-old in the nation, he's one of two or three. And, you know, I know we've had some injuries, and that happens in this three-year-old group. But going into the Belmont, I thought the three-year-old picture, and not necessarily the Belmont itself, but just the three-year-old picture of who had accomplished what, I thought this was a really, really good crop of three-year-olds this year. So I like him a lot. I like his story. I like the group that owns him. I'm a fan of everything about Tis the Law, so I hope he goes on and continues to do well. I've got an opinion on Gamin that's probably going to be different from most, and I don't want to cause any problems. But when she won first time out, I like to study trainer patterns and what they do. So she wins first time out, and then she comes to Oaklawn to run. And if you look at her past performance coming to that Oaklawn race, Baffert brings her back to the gate, works her from the gate. And that's unusual. So I was trying to figure out in my head, you know, basically an educated guess as to what the thinking was there. And I watched her first race in California, which was before, obviously, she went to the gate and worked again, and she broke from the gate fine in her race. So what I felt I saw and what I felt was the reason for that was she's not the greatest horse at relaxing. And here he is trying to make the transition from one to two turns. That can be hard to do when you have a horse that's not that mateable. And I actually thought in her next start at Oaklawn, which was a two-turn race, that she wasn't that rateable. And I thought she won it on sheer talent, not necessarily because, you know, she's just as good at two turns as one. So I looked at that race like, I'm not so sure this is a good two-turn horse. And then she came back, obviously ran one turn at Belmont and ran huge. But this idea that she's like the cinch if she runs these kind of races in the Kentucky Oaks or other two-turn races, I'm not so sure I'm in that camp yet. Now, a lot can happen in teaching a horse to relax. And if that does occur, and Bob Baffert is the greatest trainer in North America, in my opinion, well, then she's going to be just fine. But I think she has a little bit of an issue with the two-turn races and how she regulates her speed. That offers, you know, price and opportunity to the handicappers that see it that way.
I said the identical thing in the opening remarks, Tom, that, you know, for everybody that's just assuming and anointing, especially because it looks like they're going to use the, we'll talk to Baffert, but it especially because they're going to use the test, which is only going to further sharpen her speed. And I thought the exact same thing, that she just on raw talent gutted it out in that win over Speech at Oaklawn. So this is a story to follow, but the performance on Saturday was just a jaw dropper. I made the quip on Twitter that'll be a performance that an increasing number of people over the years won't be able to say they were there for.
Well put. Look, they can say what they want, but they painted in that grandstand, the Belmont telecast. I never seen anything like that in my life. You know, NBC panned the grandstand for Belmont Day, and they also panned Times Square at some point. I mean, those
Yep, things, I saw that.
You want to talk about jaw-dropping. That was as jaw-dropping as her performance, yep. Which was indeed, you're right, very jaw-dropping.
Well, No Parole really got the day's the drumbeat going. And, Tom, this was wonderful. Congratulations to Greg and Maggie and Hillendale and Coteau Grove, Louis Saez, the whole you and your whole team. Well done. And we'll be looking forward to the summer action. And we look forward daily to America's Day at the Races on Fox and MSG and your opportunities to be included as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. As always, truly, my pleasure. Appreciate you having me on.
Tom Amos, everybody, and he's got horses daily at Indiana leading into closing week at Churchill and Serengeti Empress. You might hear from Tom next Monday as well, after we'll see Serengeti and Midnight Beast. We're going to stay here because, as I told you when we started, there's just so much to talk about, and we'll spend the next little while with Nick Luck and do our annual recap of Royal Ascot. And this was a particularly fun, at least for our audience and the show, it was particularly fun. The coverage started with Nick, and then we followed up with Kev Humphreys and Vance Hansen, and a lot of you cashed tickets and some big tickets. There was so many great storylines. Nick Luck.